really don't want to frighten anybody, but I thought we might start today by doing the entire history of mankind before we get into the lesson itself. So this will be fairly abbreviated, to say the least, but I'd like to just give you a number of highlights starting clear back in the Garden of Eden. So we just see maybe a trend that is revealed pretty clearly in biblical history, that Adam and Eve is the beginning. And Adam and Eve were living in the garden, walking and talking with the God of heaven. Adam and Eve had it the best that anybody ever has. And yet, Satan was able to tempt them. Satan was able to convince first the woman, and then through her, the man, that, you know, changes could be made. They must have seen then somehow in that temptation, with which we're all so familiar, a perceived advantage. Somehow in the midst of perfection, they saw a lack and wanted to reach for it. And so, it was a delight to the eyes, it was good for food, and it was desirable to make one wise. Wisdom is a good thing, and it ought to be desirable. You really can't fault them in one sense for wanting to have more wisdom. And yet, if you read the article this morning in the bulletin, they wanted a right thing in a wrong way, didn't they? And so it resulted in disaster, a disaster that has affected every living human being since and has wrought its destructive power against us down to this very day. You skip ahead quite some years, you come to the Tower of Babel. God has ordered the people to be fruitful and to multiply, to fill the earth and to subdue it. That is an instruction from God. Obeying instructions from God is not likely to result in failure, and yet what did they do? They decided somehow that it would be better, it would be wiser, they would be somehow more successful, that somehow there was an advantage. You were not given an insight into their reasoning, but they decided, no, we're not going to go out, we're not going to fulfill this command, we are going to build a tower. And that tower will reach up to the heavens itself. So they had this grand plan to do a thing that somehow they felt would be better than what God had asked them to do. By the time you come into the wilderness, you have a people that have set out to fulfill the plan of God in receiving the gift of a promised land. And yet, as much as the people feared and even hated Egypt and the Pharaoh and the problems that they had in their slavery, what did they do in the wilderness? They also came to hate Moses and to rebel against God's appointed one. And then to lack the faith entirely while Moses was in face-to-face conversations with God on the mountain in their best interest, they decide they're going to build a calf out of gold and worship this thing. And throughout the wilderness wanderings, having left the Egyptian slavery that they were so unhappy about, they repeatedly accosted Moses with a desire to go back and have the advantages of Egypt again. Isn't it amazing how just pretty much, I guess, wherever you are, from Eden to the wilderness, that mankind has found a way to think that they could improve or do better or second guess the plans of our God. Brethren, despite all that had gone on, in 40 years of the wilderness wandering, one whole generation removed because of their reluctance and their rebellion, these people, their descendants, come to the promised land, and they have God as their king. But what happens? They're unhappy with the judges. They want to be like the nations around them. And once again, you have human beings thinking that in the midst of God's great blessings, somehow there's something lacking. We can improve upon that thing. With those ideas in mind, let's turn to Ezra chapter 3, the third chapter of Ezra. Always a hard book for me to find, so I'll help you out. It's 702 in my Bible. much at all, but nonetheless, you know, it's got Ezra there. And turn to chapter 3, where you'll find really a very famous passage. I'm sure it will immediately be familiar to you. They're rebuilding the temple that has been destroyed, Solomon's temple, because of their sins, thinking they could do things differently. But in Ezra 3 and verse 10, when the builders had laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, as his instruction, by his design, it's his temple, the priests stood in their apparel with trumpets, the Levites, the sons of Asaph, remember them, with cymbals, remember that's what they were in charge of, to praise the Lord according to the directions of King David of Israel. And they sang, praising and giving thanks to the Lord, saying, He is good, His loving kindness is upon Israel forever. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord because of the foundation of the house of the Lord being laid. Yet many of the priests and Levites and heads of fathers' households, the old men, who had seen the first temple, wept with a loud voice when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes, while they shouted aloud for joy, that is, while the others shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not distinguish the sound of the shout of joy from the sound of the weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the sound was heard far away. Hard to imagine this, unless, of course, you live close to the Austin Stadium on certain days of the week. But it's a great shout. And it is a mixture of polar opposites regarding the same event, which God Himself has done wondrous things to make happen. He has brought them back again. They know their previous history from captivity. He's brought them back to rebuild another temple. Brethren, there should only have been rejoicing in that day. And yet here they are again, these people, looking at what God is doing, comparing it in their minds with other things, in this case even that God Himself had done, and thinking that things don't add up the way they ought to. Aren't we an amazing creation? Our ability to take these most disparate events and every time seem to, you know, be able to concoct that something is wrong and that, you know, it ought to be different. Turn over to Zechariah now, chapter 4. That was a good deal easier to find, seeing that, you know, it's so close to the book of Matthew there, one of the last of your minor prophets and last of the books of the Old Testament. But in Zechariah, at the same time frame, by the way, as Ezra, look in chapter 4, and let's be reading verses 6 through 10. Now, this whole chapter is the fifth vision that Zechariah has received right here. And, of course, it goes before and after the verses we're going to read. So this vision of the lampstand and the olive trees, and we're not going to be discussing it fully at all. But I do want you to see a principle here. In chapter 4 of Zechariah, starting at verse 6, then he answered and said to me, this is the angel in the vision speaking to Zechariah, this is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel. Now, that's the great leader of Israel at the time that Zechariah is prophesying, so Governor Zerubbabel, saying to him, not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. And what's the point in all of that? What is done here is not done by human might or power. It is accomplished by the Spirit of the living God. Verse 7. What are you, O great mountain? It's the operative word there. Before Zerubbabel, you will become a plain. And he will bring forth the top stone, that is, he'll cap off the building of the temple. So that last, you know, carved stone that goes into that structure, he will bring forth the top stone with shouts of grace, grace to it. House of joy, not of lamentation, is what should have been done. And reading in verse 8, also the word of the Lord came to me saying, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house, and his hands will finish it, then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you. Here's the verse that especially we want to consider now, 10. For who has despised the day of small things? But these seven will be glad when they see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel. They see the building of this temple. The eyes of the Lord, which range to and fro throughout the earth. Now, you Revelation students, that'll sure ring a bell, wouldn't it? Seven spirits before the throne, and we've already seen there in Revelation. Well, here they are again in Zechariah. But in verse 10, who has despised the day of small things? Brethren, that's quite an indictment on this event where a much smaller temple's foundation is being laid. You have shouts of joy, and should have been that they were all shouts of joy. But you've got these people who are unhappy, and they're weeping, and they're comparing it to something that had been greater before. Well, that was God's will then. That was God's work then. And back then, that was grand and glorious. But that is not God's work now. God's work now is a small thing. And that rhetorical question is designed to teach these people, and don't you dare despise it. Don't you dare criticize this thing. Don't you dare be weeping and lamenting as you look back over history to see that it was grander at some other time. This is not done by your might. This is not done by your power. This is done by the Spirit of the living God. This is done by Jehovah. Don't you dare despise what I, God, decide needs to be done, whether large or small. Because when you do, the large gets destroyed and you go into captivity. And when it's small, I will see it through the way I want it done. You accept that and be glad for it. So in the midst of this history that we're reviewing right here, you know, take note of that instruction. Then you have a Messiah, brethren, the fulfillment of all the Old Testament, who comes to this earth. And I think in terms of who has despised the day of small things. Wasn't that something? One Lord and 12 guys, ranging from fishermen to tax collectors. Oh, that's grand, that's glorious, that's huge, that's wonderful, that's amazing, right? 13 guys. But what did they do? They changed the course of human history. And then they were gone. Jesus returned to rule. The 12 apostles fulfilled their missions and were murdered, apparently all but perhaps one. Elders and deacons, preachers, took up the work that they had occupied, and the church went into every corner of the world. Who has despised the day of small things? But was the world content with the simple thing that God had begun and accomplished? Well, no, brethren, it didn't take long at all before we had a Roman Catholic apostasy, and we couldn't be satisfied with elders and deacons and preachers, and we had to invent cardinals and monsignors and bishops and archbishops and who knows what all else, and new work, you know, and all kinds of things. And we're back at building towers to the sky again, aren't we? Basilicas, you know, and that kind of thing. And all in the name of the Lord, it looks most like the Tower of Babel. And it does that small footprint of a foundation for that second temple. The worship of Almighty God, Old Testament or New, brethren, is what God wanted. In the Old Testament, yes, it was a lot louder. Yes, it had instruments. Yes, there were choruses. Yes, that was the Old Testament worship. Don't you dare despise these smaller things when God changes them. So we come to the New Testament. We have only vocal music. It's a cappella. It's not instrumental. We have everybody doing it instead of specially trained musicians or singers. And yet, how long does it last? Before too long, they're going to work. And while actually it took quite a while, 12 centuries, 1,200 years later, what are we doing? Those who claim to love their God are off again, back to the Old Testament way of doing things with their instruments. They've introduced this, which was unknown for 1,200 years, among those that named the name of Christ. What is it, brethren, about, you know, human nature? You read in the book of Acts that they worshipped in homes and by riversides, and, you know, these small structures became what? Again, giant kinds of things in the midst of apostasy. And with it, brethren, came a hierarchy and groups of men and women that were ruling over this apostate thing and ruining it fully and completely. In the 1800s, in the good old USA, amazing thing happened. In the midst of simplicity and smallness, people began to say, you know, all this grand and glorious stuff out there, we can't read about it in our Bibles. Maybe we could get back to the book and just do it that way. And for quite a while, brethren, some 200 years ago, for quite a while, that thing was just really changing the world we lived in. These small people, in a very unpretentious way, once again, were changing the course of human history, had tremendous influence right up to and including the presidency of this great land in those 1800s. And then guess what happened to all that simplicity by the time you get to the end of the 1800s? These same people are introducing the Old Testament instruments again. They're not satisfied, you know, the simple structure and government and leadership that we have, so we need missionary societies and sponsoring churches and orphan homes and radio and TV, and we need schools from kindergarten to college, you know. And all these things got going, and some of those things are not wrong in and of themselves if only the individual saints would have taken care of their business instead of trying to turn it in to a big church-operated thing. Why do we despise the small things the way that we do? Brother, why is that? And all of this is really to get to another question. How do you define success? When you open your eyes to evaluate a thing and its goodness, its badness, its rightness, its wrongness, its success, or its failure, what sort of a paradigm, you know, what data are you using? What criteria is employed to test this thing? How do you decide what makes today, for what we're most concerned about, an individual congregation, and certainly we need this one, you know, that we're parts of right now, what makes it successful so that it's what it ought to be? That which we ought to be well content with. That over which we would offer only praise and not heap upon it criticism and grief and sorrow, you know, and regret and want it to be something different. How do you judge the success or the failure of a given church? Please open to Revelation now. In the book of Revelation last week, last Wednesday that is, in chapter 2, and again, for the teens, this morning in Revelation chapter 2, we look at God's criteria for determining the success or the failure of individual congregations. We'll be doing this again on Wednesday night for the adults because we're going to go through chapter 3, though not next Sunday because Dean's going to be teaching those teens and I will be holding a meeting up in the state of Washington. But both of these chapters, brethren, seven times, show us how God tests the success or the failure of a given congregation. Today, I'm just going to briefly read and look at Revelation 2, so in chapter of the adults, you know, and teens of teen, and we're going to look at only three of the four churches in that chapter. Let's read those first seven verses. to the angel of the church in Ephesus in Revelation 2, verse 1, the one who holds the seven stars in his right hand, the one who walks among the seven golden lampstands, says this. This will be identified as the Son of God later. There's no denying that, or mistaking, that vision John saw in the first chapter is of none other than Jesus, the Son of God. And Jesus says in verse 2, I know your deeds and your toil and perseverance, and that you cannot endure evil men, and you put to the test those who call themselves apostles, and they are not, and you found them to be false. And you have perseverance, and have endured for my name's sake, and have not grown weary. But I have this against you, that you have not built a new building in the last 10 years. The one you've got is too old. I don't think so. But I have this against you. Your music isn't pleasing enough, and I really need more cymbals and drums and, let's get an organ in there and an electric guitar, and, it'll make us happier if we do. There's anything like that, is there? There's only one thing wrong with Ephesus. They've left their first love. There's some sense of intensity and fullness of their love that has ebbed. And this, Jesus, the Son of God, is concerned about. He tells them how to fix this then. He will say to them in verse 5, remember therefore from where you have fallen. Brethren, that church has only been around for a little while. And it wasn't from towering heights of, building projects that they had fallen. Only in the category of love. And repent. Make a refreshed commitment to reject what is wrong and to do that which is right. And then do the deeds you did at first. Brethren, the deeds that this church did was to believe truth, hate error, and lead righteous lives with a vigorous love for the God that had saved them. And I might add there, I think also as a hint at least, love for the lost that they would encourage to come into this kingdom. They'd left their first love for their God and likely their first evangelistic fervor as well. And then we read in verse 7, 6 it is, yet this you do have, you hate the deeds of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. Maybe their first love was having some problems. I'm just suggesting maybe. Because its polar opposite, hate, was also having some problems. There was a man, most of you will not know, up in the state of Washington, who was just sort of the grandfather of the whole church, up there throughout much of the 20th century. Man had established quite a number of congregations and passed away an awful lot of years ago. It's been gone for a long time now. His name was Al Bass, if that rings a bell for some of you. Al Bass was one of the roughest, toughest, gruffest, just uncultured guys you ever saw. I mean, just truly. He was just, kind of rude, crude, and socially unacceptable. His family wouldn't mind me saying so. They know how much I love him. And then I just said the kind of guy he was. He was, a guy who raised horses all his life. He was a man who, was real salt of the earth. And I'm not saying he was crude in any wrong way. I'm just saying he wasn't real refined, drinking teacups, raised pinky in it, and that sort of thing. He was really blunt. And when he saw sin, that man was just a monster. He didn't like it. He didn't like false doctrine. And he wasn't going to be friendly or polite to it either. Okay? And so, a lot of the saints up there were actually embarrassed about him. And I remember one event where I was embarrassed about him. In a very public manner, he'd stood up against Mormonism, and I just thought, I was just kind of out of line there. Okay? And then I was talking about it one day with another individual. And I was sharing, kind of my hesitation with regard to this man. And he said, what I think it is that Al loves truth and hates error more than the rest of us do. And he convinced me on the spot that that's probably the case. he didn't have what might really appeal to the world. He was not the epitome of culture. But he brought so many people to Christ, you can't count them. Started a number of different congregations and did more good in his lifetime than all the rest of those cultured people, you know, for some years put together could ever accomplish. So, brother, what are we seeing here? Your hatred for evil will drive you almost as much, if not as much, as your love will also. Make sure that these two polar opposites are properly directed. Get a lot of good work done for the Lord in that man. The Ephesian church, brethren, did not build the temple of Diana. Don't know that they ever had a building of their own to even meet in. They didn't have that library of Celsus either, you know, that we saw as we were looking at the picture did on Wednesday night last. Nothing, you know, that really impressed the eyes of the flesh in any way. But was that a great church? That's a great church. Starting to fade a little, but a great church. Next church that you come to there is Smyrna. In chapter 2, let's read there, verses 8, 9, 10, 11, everything that's said about the church, very little said about this church. But the first and the last who was dead and has come to life says this, I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich, and the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you're about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison that you may be tested, and you'll have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful unto death, and I'll give you the crown of life, as long as you remember to develop a sponsoring church organization or other, you know, parachurch organizations, as they're sometimes called. If you'll do those things, you'll be okay. Anything like that in there? You know, I don't either. I just don't. They're not criticized because they don't have enough gospel meetings. They're not criticized because they haven't baptized a certain quota of people either. Let's read on. Pergamum, chapter 12, or verse 12, rather. The angel of the church of Pergamum writes, the one who has the sharp two-edged sword says this, I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is. And you hold fast my name and did not deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my witness, my faithful one, who was killed among you where Satan dwells. But I have a few things against you, because you have there some who hold the teaching of Balaam, who kept teaching Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idol, and to commit acts of fornication. And you don't have enough roving classes, and you don't employ the phone tree enough. Brother, you understand, I'm not crying out against so many of these things in and of themselves. I'm just saying, they're not on the list. What are they concerned about? What is Jesus concerned about in Revelation 2? And the closer and the longer you look, brethren, the more that you'll see is that it was individuals and that it was personal. And it had to do not with some great grand project that the churches could either, you know, build physically or design organizationally or come up in some other manner. These things may well be very valuable in themselves. I'm not addressing those things. I'm just saying that as God was looking at it, it was the individual saint. Then he would take them collectively, and that is how he would characterize the church. How each individual was faring in their relationship with him. These are the things that God is particularly concerned about. So, brothers, you look back over the history from Adam and Eve to this day. I think what you'll find is that, you know, tremendous amounts of activity is not necessarily success. You may even find in this history that growth in numbers does not equal success. Because if God grants the increase, he may not grant large numbers. frequently throughout history does not. We might, however, be able to design certain ways to get around that and have lots of people. And maybe it would be a huge mistake as well. God doesn't address the numbers that these people have in these congregations either. And brethren, I suggest that as you look back over all of this, you'll see that you don't get to control the times or the society that you're living in. It's not up to you to pick what the world about you is going to be like, and that world's going to have a profound impact on whether or not people are coming to Christ and your numbers are improving, or how well you're doing financially, you know, to do the needed repairs on the building, or any of those kinds of things. These are not the things we control. What we control is each, the individual self, and the relationship that they have with their God. And the closer that relationship is for those individuals, and how they just knuckle under to do what God wants them to do, will receive either criticism or praise collectively for that church from the great God of heaven. So, brethren, I'd like to close with Micah chapter 6. Come on back to Micah, which Pat read so well for us here a few moments ago to start our assembly. And look at this sixth chapter. And see if what he's talking about here is building, you know, towers to heaven, or golden calves, or large temple, you know, these kinds of things in the Old Testament, or similar kinds of things in the New. It says this in Micah chapter 6 and verse 6. With what shall I come to the Lord and bow myself before the God on high? Shall I come to him with burnt offerings, with yearling calves? Does the Lord take delight in thousands of rams, in 10,000s of rivers of oil? And stop right there for just a second. Remember, all four of those things were required. So he did expect them to bring him these things. They were doing right things here. But there's a point being made. Even in the middle of verse 7, shall I present my firstborn for my rebellious acts, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? Rhetorical questions. Answered in verse 8, though. He's told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? But to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. Brethren, I submit to you that whether it's the Old Testament or the New, that little outline has been God's prescription for mankind. Universally, Old Testament or New. This is how you measure success in your own life and in the congregation in which you are living. Not if they were able to present 10,000, you know, rivers of oil that the God had asked for, the God of heaven had asked for. But this, do you do justice? Do you love kindness? And do you walk humbly with your God? Not grandly, humbly with your God. And this in Ecclesiastes. Come to the book of Ecclesiastes, and let's have a look at the last chapter and the very last ideas that Solomon, the wisest of all men, suggests. He says in verse 13 of his final chapter in Ecclesiastes, the conclusion, when all has been heard, is this. Fear God. Keep his commandments, because this, depending on your translation, I rather prefer, is the whole of man. This is everything there is for you. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or it is evil. Brethren, it's really pretty simple. Now, it's not very external. It's not big. Who despises the small things? Those who maybe aren't getting the power and the importance in God's eyes of the small things. They want big things. God's looking a little more closely, perhaps. How do you judge the success or failure of the congregation here? I'll give you just a couple of quick examples. Brent, I believe, for instance, you saw something really spectacular this morning that poor Bob's been taking heat for all day, I think. Let me cut up here. Looked right at the songbook. Had the wrong tune for song now, didn't you? Sure did. And you know what he did? He carried us through that whole song. I was amazed. You know how much talent that takes? How really strong you have to be to do what he did there this morning? We said, well, yeah, he made a mistake. You know, he didn't get the tune right. And then he carried us all through that. That was quite something to see. Now, by the way, as highly as I'm commending him for that right now, I have seen it done about three other times, Bob, so you know, you're not standing head and shoulders above everybody else. It's just to say, brethren, that if you really know what you're about, then no matter what happens, and even if you slip a mental cog like I do all the time in my sermons, you are able to do what God would have you do. You know what else I mentioned? You know, I got to go hold a meeting up in Everett, Washington. I'm not going to be here next week. And Dean Anderson, just immediately, he was actually sitting in the pew getting ready to wait on the Lord's table, you know, on a Sunday morning, and it was just seconds before that assembly was going to start, and I saw him there, and I thought, oh, I got to do this. I jumped out of my chair, and I ran forward, and I just leaned over the pew and said, hey, can you teach that Bible class for me, you know, on Sunday? He goes, yeah, I'll do it. And I was gone. That you have saints that can do these kinds of things. And then this morning, in just a matter of very few minutes, brethren, I suggested that this congregation might think about giving above and beyond the call of duty. And let me say to you, these business meetings we have, you know, on the second Sunday of every month, the elders allow me to sit in. I've told you before, I'm really impressed with those elders. They really am, but in the course of that meeting today, they were just saying, isn't it just, you know, excellent how the saints rose up to meet that need? Impressed with what already was given instantly after that assembly this morning. I saw more money changing hands tonight. Bill's in it also, you know, to see that those saints' needs get met. How do you judge the success or the failure of a congregation? Brethren, it's not necessarily, well, we have to knock out a wall, you know, build bigger room because we're just exploding. I've seen many churches explode in shame. Bring people in, you know, by the droves and not understand anything about the doctrine of their God that they were forsaking in order to do it. What I'm saying, brethren, is that as God views a congregation, what he's looking at is to see if you are knit together in love as a family that just loves kindness and walks humbly and fears God, keeps his commandments. That's what I think I see in this congregation. Could we do better? Sure we can. Don't you ever dare to despise the day of the small things that God does with each and every one of you in your heart. Because it's pretty grand, it's pretty glorious, it's pretty big in his view. When you just go about the tasks that he has asked you to do. You know what else they had commended was the way this congregation is always given. Oh, it was amazing to see. We need to help Emilio Alvarez on Marinduque Island. By the way, Lenny was admiring my telephone tonight. I've got a new smartphone. Yeah, it's pretty nice. Got a lot of features. There's an app you can buy. You get to pick from about 100 languages, and then you just speak the words right at your phone, and it'll translate them for you. Don't believe they have Latin, though. Something's wrong there. Brother, what I'm saying is, these elders are as impressed as I am with the heart and soul of the Cobra Grove congregation. Good for you. So we're not as big as, you know, you might want us to be, and maybe the building's aging a little bit, you know, those kinds of things. What does it matter? We're like the people of God have always been the people of God. Appreciate your attention. As always, we make the appeal if you have been thinking and studying about joining us, that you would be a part of the Church of Christ, that you would be a part of God's kingdom, that you believe that Jesus is the Son of the living God. You have decided that you want to do something about it, and you can speak with your lips. This great confession has been made for 2,000 years. Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And would be baptized in an act of humility so that the blood of Jesus Christ might be applied to your soul. Let today be the day of salvation. Or if we can help you with some struggle that you're involved in, I don't think I ever saw a family more talented or more eager to help in any way they possibly can. If we can help you, come tell me, please, as we stand and sing.